lightning flowed between them. The older man smiled.
"I think," said Rick, "that only the Abbot of Swords can answer that question. For all of us."
Vintar nodded and closed his eyes for several moments. Each man knew he was searching their hearts and minds, yet there was no fear, no embarrassment, no desire any longer to be alone.
"All things that live must die," said Vintar. "Man alone, it seems, lives all his life in the knowledge of death. And yet there is more to life than merely waiting for death. For life to have meaning, there must be a purpose. A man must pass something on, otherwise it is useless. For most men, that purpose revolves around marriage and children who will carry on his seed. For others, it is an ideal, a dream, if you like. Each of us here believes in the concept of honour, that it is man's duty to do that which is right and just. That might alone is not enough. We have all transgressed at some time. We have stolen, lied, cheated, even killed for our own ends. But ultimately we return to our beliefs. We do not allow the nadir to pass unchallenged, because we cannot. We judge ourselves more harshly than others can judge us. We know that death is preferable to betrayal of that which we hold dear. Hogan, you are a soldier, and you have faith in the Drenai cause. You have been told to stand, and will do so without question. It would not occur to you that there were any alternatives but to obey. And yet you understand when others think differently. You are a rare man. Bowman, you are a romantic, and yet a cynic. You mock the nobility of man, for you have seen that too often nobility gives way to more base desires. Yet you have secretly set yourself standards which other men will never understand. You, more than any of the others, desire to live. The urge is strong in you to run away. But you will not. Not as long as a single man stands to defend these walls. Your courage is great. Rick, you are the most difficult to answer for. Like Bowman, you are a romantic, but there is a depth to you which I have not tried to plumb. You are intuitive and intelligent, but it is your intuition that guides you. You know it is right that you stay, and also senseless that you stay. Your intellect tells you that this cause is folly, but your intuition forces you to reject your intellect. You are that rare animal, a born leader of men, and you cannot leave. All of you are bound together in chains 1,000 times stronger than steel. And finally there is one who comes now, for which all I have said remains true. He is a lesser man than any here, and yet a greater, for his fears are greater than yours, and yet he also will stand firm and die beside you. The door opened and Orin entered, his armor bright and freshly oiled. Silently he sat among them, accepting a goblet of wine.
"I trust Ulrich was in good health," he said. "He has never looked better, old horse," answered Bowman. "Then we will give him a bloody nose tomorrow," said the general, his dark eyes gleaming.
The dawn sky was bright and clear as the Drenai warriors ate a cold breakfast of bread and cheese, washed down with honeyed water. Every man who could stand manned the walls, blades to the ready. As the nadir prepared to advance, Rek leapt to the battlements and turned to face the defenders.
"No long speeches today," he shouted. "We all know our plight, but I want to say that I am proud, more proud than I could ever have imagined. I wish I could find words.
He stammered to silence, then lifted his sword from its scabbard and held it high.
By all the gods that ever walked, I swear that you are the finest men I ever knew. And if I could have chosen the end of this tale and peopled it with heroes of the past, I would not change a single thing. For no one could have given more than you have. And I thank you. But if any man here wishes to leave now, he may do so. Many of you have wives, children, others depending on you. If that be the case, leave now with my blessing. For what we do here today will not affect the outcome of the war.
He leapt lightly to the ramparts to rejoin Orin and Hogan. Further along the line, a young Kul shouted,
What of you, Earl of Bronze? Will you stay?
Rex stepped to the wall once more.
I must stay, but I give you leave to go.
No man moved, though many considered it. The Nadir war cry rose, and the battle began. Throughout that long day, no foothold could be gained by the Nadir, and the carnage was terrible. The great sword of Egil lunged and slew, cleaving armor, flesh, and bone, and the Drenai fought like demons, cutting and slaying ferociously. For these, as Cerbatar had predicted so many weeks ago, were the finest of the fighting men, and death and fear of death had no place in their minds. Time and again the Nadir reeled back, bloodied and bemused. But as dusk approached, the assault on the gates strengthened, and the great barrier of bronze and oak began to buckle. Cerbatar led the last of the 30 to stand, as Drass had done, in the shadow of the gate porch. Rek raced to join them, but a withering mind pulse from Cerbatar ordered him back to the wall. He was about to resist when Nadir warriors scrambled over the ramparts behind him. Egil's sword flashed, beheading the first, and Rek was once more in the thick of battle. In the gateway, Cerbatar was joined by Subodin, the captain of his Vagrian bodyguard. Only some 60 men were still alive out of the force which had originally arrived. "Go back to the walls," said Cerbatar. The fair-haired Vagrian shook his head.
"I cannot. We are here as your Carl guard, and we will die with you."
"You bear me no love, Subodin. You have made that plain."
"Love has little to do with my duty, Lord Cerbatar. Even so, I hope you will forgive me. I thought your powers were demon-sent, but no man possessed would stand as you do now."
"There is nothing to forgive, but you have my blessing," Cerbatar told the blonde Carl captain.
The gates splintered suddenly, and with a roar of triumph, the Nadir burst through, hurling themselves upon the defenders, spearheaded by the white-haired Templar. Drawing a slender Ventrian dagger, Cerbatar fought two-handed, blocking, stabbing, parrying, and cutting. Men fell before him, but always more leapt to fill the breach he created. Beside him, the slim Vagrian Carl captain hacked and hammered at the oncoming barbarians. An axe splintered his shield, but hurling aside the fragments, he took a double-handed grip on his sword, bellowed his defiance, and launched himself forward. An axe crushed his ribs, and a lance tore into his thigh. He fell into the seething mass, stabbing left and right. A kick sent him sprawling to his back, and three spears buried themselves in his chest. Feebly he sought to lift his sword for one last time, but an iron-studded boot stamped on his hand, while a blow from a wooden club ended his life. Vintar fought coolly, pushing himself alongside the albino, waiting for the arrow he knew would be loosed at any second. Ducking beneath a slashing sword, he disemboweled his opponent and turned. In the shadows of the sundered gates, an archer drew back on his string, his fingers nestling against his cheek. The shaft leapt from the bow to take Vintar in the right eye, and he fell against the Nadir spears. The remaining defenders fought in an ever-tightening circle, as dusk deepened into night. The Nadir cries were silenced now, the battle tense and silent, but for the sounds of steel on steel on flesh. Menahem was lifted from his feet by the force of a stabbing spear that tore into his lungs. His sword whistled down towards the neck of the kneeling lancer and stopped. Lightly he touched the blade to the man's shoulder.
Unable to believe his luck, the warrior dragged his spear free and buried it once more in the priest's chest. Now Serbitar was alone. Momentarily the nadir fell back, staring at the blood-covered albino. Much of the blood was his own. His cloak was in tatters, his armour gashed and dented, his helm long since knocked from his head. He took three deep, shuddering breaths, looked inside himself, and saw that he was dying. Reaching out with his mind, he sought Vintar and the others. Silence. A terrible silence. It was all for nothing, then, he thought, as the nadir tensed for the kill. He chuckled wryly. There was no source, no center to the universe. In the last seconds left to him, he wondered if his life had been a waste. He knew it had not, for even if there was no source, there ought to have been, for the source was beautiful. A nadir warrior sprang forward. Serbitar flicked aside his thrust, burying his dagger in the man's breast, but the pack surged in, a score of sharp blades meeting inside his frail form. Blood burst from his mouth, and he fell. From a great distance came a voice.
"Take my hand, my brother. We travel."
It was Vintar.
The nadir surged and spread towards the deserted Delnok buildings and the score of streets that led to Gedon and the keep beyond. In the front line, Ogasi raised his sword, bellowing the nadir victory chant. He began to run, then skidded to a halt. Ahead of him, on the open ground before the buildings, stood a tall man with a trident beard, dressed in the white robes of the Setuli. He carried two tulwars, curved and deadly. Ogasi advanced slowly, confused.
A Setuli within the Drenai fortress?
"What do you do here?"
yelled Ogasi.
"Merely helping a friend," replied the man. "Go back. I shall not let you pass."
Ogasi grinned. So the man was a lunatic. Lifting his sword, he ordered the tribesmen forward. The white-robed figure advanced on them.
"Setuli!"
he yelled. From the buildings came a mighty answering roar as 3,000 Setuli warriors, their white robes ghostly in the gathering darkness, streamed to the attack. The nadir was stunned, and Ogasi could not believe his eyes. The Setuli and the Drenai were lifelong enemies. He knew it was happening, but his brain would not drink it in. Like a white tide on a dark beach, the Setuli front line crashed into the nadir. Joachim sought Ogasi, but the stocky tribesman was lost amid the chaos. The savage twist to events, from certain victory to certain death, dismayed the tribesmen. Panic set in, and a slow withdrawal became a rout. Trampling their comrades, the nadir turned and ran, with the white army at their backs, harrying them on with screams as bestial as any heard on the nadir steps. On the walls above, Rek was bleeding from wounds in his upper arms, and Hogan had suffered a sword cut to his scalp, blood running from the gash and skin flapping as he lashed out at his attackers. Now Setuli warriors appeared on the battlements, and once more the nadir fled their terrible tulwars, backing to the walls and seeking escape down the ropes. Within minutes it was over. Elsewhere on the open ground, small pockets of nadir warriors were surrounded and dispatched. Joachim Setuli, his white robes stained with crimson, slowly mounted the rampart steps, followed by his seven lieutenants. He approached Rek and bowed. Turning, he handed his bloody tulwars to a dark-bearded warrior. Another man passed him a scented towel. Slowly, elaborately, he wiped his face and then his hands. Finally he spoke. "A warm welcome," he said, his face unsmiling, but his eyes full of humour.
"Indeed," said Rek. "It is lucky the other guests had to leave. Otherwise there would not have been any room."
"Are you so surprised to see me?"
"No,
not surprised. Astonished sounds more accurate.
Joachim laughed. Is your memory so short, Delnok? You said we should part as friends, and I agreed. Where else should I be in a friend's hour of need?
You must have had the devil's own task, convincing your warriors to follow you.
Not at all, answered Joachim, an impish gleam in his eyes. Most of their lives they have longed to fight inside these walls.
The tall Setuli warrior stood on the high walls of Gedon, gazing down at the Nadir camp beyond the deserted battlements of Valteri. Rek was asleep now, and the bearded prince strode the walls alone. Around him were sentries and soldiers of both races, but Joachim remained solitary. For weeks, Setuli scouts atop the Delnok range had watched the battle raging below. Often Joachim himself had scaled the peaks to view the fighting. Then a Nadir raiding party had struck at a Setuli village, and Joachim had persuaded his men to follow him to Delnok. Added to this, he knew of the traitor who dealt with the Nadir, for he had witnessed a meeting in a high narrow pass between the traitor and the Nadir captain Ogasi. 2 days later, the Nadir had tried to send a force over the mountains, and the Setuli had repulsed them. Joachim heard the news of Rek's loss with sadness. Fatalistic himself, he could still share the feelings of a man whose woman had died. His own had died in childbirth 2 years before, and the wound was still fresh. Joachim shook his head. War was a savage mistress, but a woman of power nonetheless. She could wreak more havoc in a man's soul than time. The Setuli arrival had been timely, and not without cost. 400 of his men were dead, a loss scarcely bearable to a mountain people who numbered a mere 30,000, many of these being children and ancients. But a debt was a debt. The man Hogun hated him, Joachim knew. But this was understandable, for Hogun was of the Legion, and the Setuli had spilt Legion blood for years. They reserved their finest tortures for captured riders. This was an honour, but Joachim knew the Drenai could never understand. When a man died, he was tested. The harder the death, the greater the rewards in paradise. Torture advanced a man's soul, and the Setuli could offer no greater reward to a captured enemy. He sat upon the battlements and stared back at the keep. For how many years had he longed to take this fortress? How many of his dreams had been filled with pictures of the keep in flames? And now he was defending it with the lives of his followers. He shrugged. A man with his eyes on the sky does not see the scorpion below his feet. A man with his eyes on the ground does not see the dragon in the air. He paced the ramparts, coming at last to the gate tower and the stone inscription carved there. Gedon, the wall of death. The air was thick with the smell of death, and the morning would see the crows fly in to the feast. He should have killed Rek in the woods. A promise to an unbeliever was worth nothing, so why had he kept it? He laughed suddenly, accepting the answer. Because the man had not cared. And Joachim liked him. He passed a Drenai sentry, who saluted him and smiled. Joachim nodded, noting the uncertainty of the smile. He had told the Earl of Bronze that he and his men would stay for one more day and then return to the mountains. He had expected a plea to remain, offers, promises, treaties, but Rek had merely smiled. It is more than I would have asked for, he said. Joachim was stunned, but he could say nothing. He told Rek of the traitor and of the Nadir attempt to cross the mountains. Will you still bar the way?
Of course. That is Setuli land.
Good. Will you eat with me?
No, but I thank you for the offer.
No Setuli could break bread with an unbeliever. Rek nodded. I think I will rest now, he said. I will see you at dawn.
In his high room in the keep, Rex slept, dreaming of Virai, always of Virai. He awoke hours before dawn and reached out for her. But the sheets beside him were cold, and, as always, he felt the loss anew. On this night he wept, long and soundlessly. Finally he rose, dressed, and descended the stairs to the small hall. The manservant, Arshin, brought him a breakfast of cold ham and cheese, with a flagon of cold water laced with honey mead. He ate mechanically, until a young officer approached with the news that Bricklin had returned with dispatches from Drenan. The burgher entered the hall, bowed briefly, and approached the table, laying before Rek several packages and a large sealed scroll. He seated himself opposite Rek and asked if he could pour himself a drink. Rek nodded as he opened the scroll. He read it once, smiled, then laid it aside and looked across at the burgher. He was thinner and perhaps even greyer than the first time Rek had seen him. He was still dressed in riding clothes, and his green cloak was dust-covered. Bricklin drained the water in two swallows and refilled his cup. Then he noticed Rek's eyes upon him. "You have seen the message from Abelaine?" he asked. "Yes. Thank you for bringing it. Will you stay?" "But of course. Surrender arrangements must be made, and Ulrich welcomed to the keep."
"He has promised to spare no one," said Rek softly.
Bricklin waved his hand. "Nonsense! That was war talk. Now he will be magnanimous."
"And what of Wundweaver?"
"He has been recalled to Drenan, and the army disbanded."
"Are you pleased?"
"That the war is over? Of course. Though I am naturally saddened that so many had to die. I hear that Dus fell at Sumitos. A great shame. He was a fine man and a magnificent warrior. But it was as he would wish to go, I am sure. When would you like me to see Lord Ulrich?"
"As soon as you wish. Will you accompany me?"
"No."
"Then who will?"
asked Bricklin, noting with pleasure the resignation mirrored in Rek's face.
"No one."
"No one? But that would not be politic, my lord. There should be a deputation."
"You will travel alone."
"Very well. What terms shall I negotiate?"
"You will negotiate nothing. You will merely go to Ulrich and say that I have sent you."
"I do not understand, my lord. What would you have me say?"
"You will say that you have failed."
"Failed? In what? Well, you speak in riddles. Are you mad?"
"No. Just tired."
"You betrayed us, Bricklin, but then I expect nothing less from your breed. Therefore I am not angry, or vengeful. You have taken Ulrich's pay, and now you may go to him. The letter from Abelaine is a forgery, and Wundweaver will be here in 5 days with over 50,000 men. Outside there are 3,000 Satuli, and we can hold the wall. Now be gone. Hogan knows that you are a traitor, and has told me that he will kill you if he sees you. Go now." For several minutes, Bricklin sat stunned. Then he shook his head.
"This is madness. You cannot hold. It is Ulrich's day. Can you not see it? The Drenai are finished, and Ulrich's star shines. What do you hope to achieve?"
Rek slowly drew a long, slender dagger and placed it on the table before him.
"Go now," he repeated quietly.
Bricklin rose and stormed to the door. He turned in the doorway.
"You fool," he spat. "Use the dagger on yourself, for what the Nadir will do when they take you will make merry viewing."
Then he was gone. Ogun stepped from behind a tapestry-covered alcove and moved to the table. His head was bandaged and his face pale. In his hand he held his sword. "How could you let him go, Rek? How?" Rek smiled. because I couldn't be bothered to kill him. Chapter 30. The last candle guttered and died as the light autumn wind billowed the curtains. Rex slept on, head resting on his arms, at the table where only an hour before he had sent Bricklin to the Nadir. His sleep was light but dreamless. He shivered as the room became cooler, then awoke with a start in the darkness. Fear touched him, and he reached for his dagger. He shivered again. It was cold. So cold. He glanced at the fire. It was blazing, but no heat reached him. He stood and walked towards it, squatting in front of it and opening his hands to the heat. Nothing. Confused, he stood once more and turned back to the table, and then the shock hit him. Head resting on his arms, the figure of Earl Regnack still slept there. He fought down panic, watching the sleeping form, noting the weariness in the gaunt face, the dark, hollowed eyes, and the lines of strain about the mouth. Then he noticed the silence. Even at this late hour of deepest darkness, some sound should be heard from sentries or servants or the few cooks preparing the morning's breakfast. But there was nothing. He moved to the doorway and beyond, into the darkened corridor, then beyond that, into the shadow of the portcullis gate. He was alone. Beyond the gate were the walls, but no sentries paced them. He walked on in the darkness, and the clouds cleared and the moon shone brightly. The fortress was deserted. From the high walls of Gedon, he looked to the north. The plain was empty. No Nadir tents were pitched there. So he was truly alone. Panic left him, and a deep sense of peace covered his soul like a warm blanket. He sat on the ramparts, gazing back at the keep. Was this a taste of death, he wondered, or merely a dream? He cared not, whether a foretaste of tomorrow's reality or the result of a needed fantasy was immaterial. He was enjoying the moment. And then, with a deep sense of warmth, he knew that he was not alone. His heart swelled and tears came to his eyes. He turned, and she was there. Dressed as he had first seen her, with a bulky sheepskin jerkin and woolen trews, she opened her arms and walked into his embrace. He held her tightly to him, pressing his face into her hair. For a long time they stood thus, while deep sobs racked his body. Finally the crying subsided, and he gently released her. She looked up at him and smiled. "You have done well, Rick," she said. "I am so proud of you." "Without you, it is meaningless," he said. "I wouldn't change anything, Rick. If they told me that I could have my life again, but not meet you, I would refuse. What does it matter that we had only months? What months they were!" "I never loved anyone as I loved you," he said. "I know." They talked for hours, but the moon shone from the same place, and the stars were static, the night eternal. Finally she kissed him to stem his words. "There are others you must see." He tried to argue, but she held her fingers to his mouth. "We will meet again, my love. For now, speak to the others." Around the walls was now a mist, swirling and thick. Overhead the moon shone in a cloudless sky. She walked into the mist and was gone. He waited, and soon a figure in silver armor came towards him. As always, he looked fresh and alert. His armor reflected the moonlight, and his white cloak was spotless. He smiled. "Well met, Rek," said Serbitar. They clasped hands in the warrior's grip. "The Setuli came," said Rek. "You held the gate just long enough." "I know. Tomorrow will be hard, and I will not lie to you. All futures have I seen,
and in only one do you survive the day. But there are forces here which I cannot explain to you, and even now their magic is at work. Fight well. Will Woundweaver arrive? Asked Rek.
Serbitar shrugged.
Not tomorrow. Then we will fall. It is likely. But if you do not, I want you to do something for me.
Name it, said Rek.
Go once more to Egil's room, where there is a last gift for you. The servant Arshin will explain.
What is it? Is it a weapon? I could use it tomorrow.
It is not a weapon. Go there tomorrow night.
Serbitar?
Yes, my friend.
Was all as you dreamed it would be?
The source, I mean.
Yes, and so much more. But I cannot speak of it now.
Wait for a while longer. There is another who must speak with you.
The mist deepened, and Serbitar's white form drew back until he merged and was gone. Andras was there, mighty and strong, his black jerkin glistening, his axe at his side.
He gave me a fine send-off, said Druss. How are you, boy? You look tired.
I am tired, but all the better for seeing you.
Druss clapped him on the shoulder and laughed.
That Nagusha used a poisoned blade on me. I tell you, laddie, it hurt like hell. Kaiser dressed me. I don't know how she got me to my feet. Still, she did.
I saw it, said Rek.
Aye, a grand exit, was it not? That young lad Gilad fought well. I have not seen him yet, but I expect I shall. You're a good boy, Rek. Worthy. It was good to know you.
And you, Druss. I never met a better man.
Of course you did, boy. Hundreds. But it's nice of you to say it. However, I didn't come here to exchange compliments. I know what you are facing, and I know tomorrow will be hard, damned hard. But don't give ground. Do not retreat to the keep. Whatever happens, hold the wall. Much rests on it. Keep Joachim beside you. If he dies, you are finished. I must go. But remember, hold the wall. Do not retreat to the keep.
I will remember. Goodbye, Druss.
Not goodbye. Not yet, said Druss. Soon.
The mist moved forward, enveloping the axeman and sweeping over Rek. Then the moonlight faded, and dark descended on the Earl of Bronze. Back in the keep, Rek awoke. The fire still burned, and he was hungry again. In the kitchens, Arshin was preparing breakfast. The old man was tired, but he brightened when Rek walked in. He liked the new earl, and remembered when Virai's father, Delnar, had been a young man, proud and strong. There seemed a similarity, but perhaps, Arshin thought, the long years had distorted his memory. He handed the earl some toasted bread and honey, which he wolfed down, following it with watered wine. Back in his quarters, Rek buckled his armor into place and made his way to the battlements. Ogun and Orin were already there, supervising the barricade within the gate tunnel.
"This is the weak spot," said Orin. "We should retire to the keep. At least the gates will hold for some hours."
Rek shook his head. "We will stand on Gedan. There must be no retreat." "Then we shall die here," said Hogan, "for that barricade will hold them not at all."
"Perhaps," said Rek, "we shall see."
"Good morning, Joachim Satuli."
The bearded warrior nodded and smiled.
"You slept well, Earl of Bronze?"
"Well, indeed. I thank you for giving us this day of your time."
"It is nothing. The payment of a small debt."
"You owe me nothing. But I tell you this, if we survive this day, there shall be no more war between us. The rights to the High Delnok passes are mine, though you dispute the rights of the Drenai to them. Therefore, before these witnesses, I give them to you. There is also a scroll bearing my seal at the keep. When you leave tonight, you shall have it. A copy will go to Abilene in Drennan. I know that the gesture will have little meaning if the Nadir win through today, but it is all I can do.
Joachim bowed. The gesture is enough in itself.
The talk ceased as the Nadir drum sounded, and the warriors of Drostelnok spread out along the wall to receive the attackers. Rek lowered his helm visor and drew the sword of Egil. Below, in the barricaded gate tunnel, stood Orin and 100 warriors. The tunnel was only 20 feet wide at the center, and Orin reckoned to hold it for the greater part of the morning. After that, with the barricades torn down, the sheer weight of the Nadir horde would push them back into the open ground behind the ramparts. And so the last bloody day began at Drostelnok. Chapter 31. Wave after wave of screaming tribesmen scaled ropes and ladders throughout the morning, finding that only cold, terrible death awaited them under the slashing swords and tulwars of the defenders. Men fell screaming to the rocks below the walls, or died trampled beneath the feet of battling men on the ramparts. Side by side, Setuli and Drenai brought death to the Nadir. Rek cut and slashed two-handed, the sword of Egil cleaving the ranks of the Nadir like a scythe through wheat. Beside him, Joachim fought with two short swords, whirling and killing. Below, Orin's men were being pushed slowly back into the wider section of the tunnel, though the Nadir paid dearly for every inch of ground. Blocking a thrusting lance, Orin backhanded a slashing cut to a warrior's face. The man disappeared in the milling mass, and another attacker took his place.
"We can't hold!" yelled a young officer to Orin's right. Orin had no time to answer. Suddenly the leading Nadir warrior screamed in horror, pushing back into his comrades. Others followed his gaze, looking back beyond the Drenai at the tunnel mouth. A gap opened between the Drenai and the Nadir, and widened as the tribesmen turned and fled down into the open grounds between Valteri and Gedon.
"Great gods, a missile!" said the officer. "What's going on?"
Orin turned and saw what had filled the Nadir with terror. Behind them, in the darkened tunnel, stood Druss the Legend, Serbitar, and the 30. With them were many departed warriors. Druss's axe was in his hand, and the joy of battle in his eyes. Orin swallowed, then licked his lips. He replaced his sword in its scabbard at the third attempt.
"I think we will leave them to hold the tunnel," he said.
The remaining men bunched behind him as he walked towards Druss. The ghostly defenders appeared not to notice them, their eyes fixed on the tunnel beyond. Orin tried to speak to Druss, but the old man just stared ahead. When Orin reached out a shaking hand and tried to touch the axe man, his hand met nothing, only cold, cold air.
"Let us get back to the wall," he said.
He closed his eyes and walked blindly through the ranks of the spirits. By the time he reached the tunnel mouth, he was shivering. The other men with him said nothing. No one looked back. He joined Rek on the wall, and the battle continued. Moments later, during a brief lull, Rek shouted,
"What's happening in the tunnel?"
"Druss is there," replied Orin.
Rek merely nodded and turned again as fresh Nadir warriors breasted the ramparts. Bowmen, bearing short sword and buckler, fought beside Hogan. Though not as skilled with the blade as with the bow, he was no mean warrior. Hogan blocked an axe blow, and his sword snapped. The axe head crushed his shoulder, burying itself in his chest. He hammered the broken sword into the belly of the axeman and fell with him to the ground. A lance licked out, spearing the legion general's back as he struggled to rise. Bowman's short sword disemboweled the lancer, but more Nadir pressed forward, and Hogan's body was lost in the melee. By the gate tower, Joachim Setuli fell, his side pierced by a thrown spear. Rek half carried him beyond the ramparts, but had to leave him, for the Nadir had almost broken through.
Joachim gripped the spear with both hands, sweat breaking out on his forehead, and examined the wound. The point had passed through just above the right hip and broken the skin of his back. The head, he knew, was barbed, and there would be no drawing it out. He gripped the spear more firmly, rolled to his side, then pushed it further into the wound until the whole of the spearhead cleared his back. He passed out for several minutes, but the gentle touch of a hand roused him. A Setuli warrior named Andisim was beside him.
"Remove the head of the spear," Joachim hissed. "Quickly!"
Wordlessly, the man took his dagger and, as gently as possible, levered the spearhead from the shaft. At last it was done.
"Now," whispered Joachim, "pull the shaft clear."
Standing above him, the man slowly withdrew the spear as Joachim grunted against the agony. Blood gushed out, but Joachim ripped his robe and plugged the wound, allowing Andisim to do the same for the hole in his back.
"Get me to my feet," he ordered, "and fetch me a tulwar."
Beyond the walls of Eldebar, within his tent, Ulrich watched the sands fall in the huge glass. Beside him was the scroll he had received that morning from the north. His nephew, Jahangir, had declared himself Khan, overlord of the north. He had slain Ulrich's brother, Tubodi, and taken Ulrich's mistress, Hasita, as hostage. Ulrich could not blame him and felt no anger. His family were born to lead, and blood ran true among them. But he could not dally here, and so he had set the glass. If the wall had not fallen by the time the sand ran out, he would lead his army north again, win back his kingdom, and return to take Dros Delnok on another day. He had received the message about Dros holding the tunnel and had shrugged. Alone once more, he had smiled.
"So, not even paradise can keep you from the battle, old man."
Outside his tent stood three men bearing ram's horns, waiting for his signal. And the sands flowed on. On the wall of Gedon, the nadir broke through to the right. Rex screamed for Orin to follow him and cut a path along the ramparts. To the left, more nadir gained the ramparts, and the Drenai fell back, leaping to the grass and reforming. The nadir swarmed forward. The day was lost. Setuli and Drenai waited, swords ready, as the nadir massed before them. Bowman and Orin stood beside Rex, and Joachim Setuli limped towards them.
"I am glad we are only offering you one day," grunted Joachim, clutching the bloody bandage wedged into his side.
The nadir spread out before them and charged. Rek leaned on his sword blade, breathing deeply and saving what was left of his strength. There was no longer the energy inside him to promote a berserk rage, nor the will. All his life he had feared this moment, and now that it was upon him, it was as meaningless as dust upon the ocean. Wearily he focused his gaze on the charging warriors.
"I say, old horse," muttered Bowman, "do you think it's too late to surrender?"
Rek grinned.
"Just a little," he said.
His hands curled around the sword hilt. He twisted his wrist and the blade hissed into the air. The front ranks of the nadir were less than 20 paces from them, when the sound of distant ram's horns echoed up from the valley. The charge slowed and stopped. Less than 10 paces apart, both sides stood listening to the insistent wailing. Agassi cursed and spat, sheathing his sword. He stared sullenly into the astonished eyes of the Earl of Bronze. Rek removed his helm and plunged his sword into the ground before him as Agassi stepped forward.
"It is over," he said.
He lifted his arm, waving the nadir back to the walls. Then he turned.
"Know this, you round-eyed bastard. It was I, Agassi, who slew your wife."
It took a few seconds for the words to register. Then Rek took a deep breath and removed his gauntlets.
"Do you think it matters, amid all this," said Rek, "to know you fired one arrow? You want me to remember you, I shall. You want me to hate you? I cannot. Maybe tomorrow. Or next year. Maybe never.
For a moment, Agassi stood silent. Then he shrugged. The arrow was meant for you, he said, weariness settling on him like a dark cloak. Turning on his heel, he followed the departing warriors. Silently, they climbed down the ladders and ropes. None took the path through the gate tunnel. Rek unbuckled his breastplate and walked slowly to the tunnel mouth. Coming towards him were Druss and the 30. Rek lifted a hand in greeting, but a wind blew and the warriors vanished into mist and were gone.
Goodbye, Druss, he said softly.
Later that evening, Rek bade farewell to the Setuli and slept for several hours, hoping for another meeting with Firai. He awoke refreshed, but disappointed. Arshin brought him food, and he ate with Bowman and Orin. They said little. Kalvar Sin and his orderlies had found Hogan's body, and the surgeon was laboring to save the hundreds of wounded men now being carried to the Gedon Hospital. Rek made his way to his room around midnight and removed his armor. Then he remembered Serbitar's gift. He was too tired to care, but sleep would not come. So he rose and dressed, took a torch from a wall bracket, and made his way slowly down into the bowels of the keep. The door to Egil's room was closed once more, but it opened to him as before. The lights blazed within as Rek placed his torch against the wall and stepped inside. His breath caught in his throat as he gazed on the crystal block. Within it lay Virai. Upon her body was no mark, no arrow wound. She lay naked and peaceful, seemingly asleep, floating within the transparent crystal. He walked to the block, reached inside, and touched her. She did not stir, and her body was cold. Stooping, he lifted her clear and placed her on a nearby table. Then he removed his cloak, wrapped it around her, and lifted her again. Gathering up the torch, he made his slow way back to his room above the keep hall. He summoned Arshin, and the old retainer blanched as he saw the still form of the Earl's wife. He looked at Rek, then gazed at the floor.
I am sorry, my lord. I do not know why the white-haired one placed her body in the magic crystal.
What happened? Asked Rek.
The Prince Serbitar and his friend the Abbot came to see me on the night she died. The Abbot had had a dream, he said. He would not explain it to me, but he said it was vital that my lady's body be placed within the crystal. He said something about the source. I didn't understand it. I still don't, my lord. Is she alive or dead? And how did you find her? We laid her upon this crystal block, and she gently sank into it. Yet when I touched it, it was solid. I understand nothing any more.
Tears welled in the old man's eyes, and Rek moved to him, placing a hand on his bony shoulder.
It is all hard to explain. Fetch Kalvar Sin. I will wait here with Firai.
A dream of Vintar's. What could it mean? The Albino had said there were many tomorrows, and that no one could ever tell which would come to pass. But he had obviously seen one in which Virai lived and had ordered her body to be preserved. And somehow the wound had been healed inside the crystal. But did that mean she would live? Virai alive? His mind reeled. He could neither think nor feel, and his body seemed numb. Her death had all but destroyed him. Yet now, with her here once more, he was afraid to hope.
If life had taught him anything, it had shown him that every man has a breaking point. He knew he was now facing his. He sat by the bed and lifted her cold hand, his own hand shaking with tension, and felt for a pulse. Nothing. Crossing the room, he fetched another blanket and covered her, then went to work building a fire in the hearth. It was nearly an hour before he heard Kalvar Sin on the stairs outside. The man was cursing Arshin loudly. Wearing a stained blue tunic and a blood-covered leather apron, the surgeon stepped into the room.
"What fool nonsense is this, Earl?" he thundered. "I have men who are dying for want of my skills."
"What?" he stammered to silence as he saw the girl in the bed. So, the old man was not lying. "Why, Wreck? Why have you brought her body back?" "I don't know. Truly, Serbitar came to me in a dream and told me he had left a gift for me. This is what I found. I don't know what's happening. Is she dead?"
"Of course she's dead. The arrow pierced her lung."
"Look at her, will you? There's no wound." The surgeon pulled back the sheet and lifted her wrist. For several moments he stood in silence. "There is a pulse," he whispered, "but it is faint and very, very slow. I cannot wait with you. There are men dying. But I will return in the morning. Keep her warm. That's all you can do."
Wreck sat beside the bed, holding her hand. Sometime, though he knew not when, he fell asleep beside her. The dawn broke bright and clear, and the rising sun's light entered the eastern window, bathing the bed in golden light. At its touch, Virai's cheeks gained color, and her breathing deepened. A soft moan came from her lips, and Wreck was instantly awake.
"Virai, Virai, can you hear me?"
Her eyes opened, then closed again, her lashes fluttering.
"Virai."
Once more her eyes opened, and she smiled.
"Serbitar brought me back," she said. "So tired. Must sleep."
She turned over, hugged the pillow, and fell asleep, just as the door opened and Bowman stepped inside.
"God, it's true then," he said.
Wreck ushered him from the room into the corridor.
"Yes, somehow Serbitar saved her. I cannot explain it. I don't even care how it happened. What is going on outside?"
"They've gone. All of them. Every damned one of them, old horse. The camp is deserted. Orin and I have been there. All that's left is a wolf's head standard and the body of that burgher, Bricklin. Can you make any sense out of it?"
"No," said Wreck. "That standard means that Ulric will return. The body? I can't say. I sent him to them. He was a traitor. And obviously they had no more use for him."
A young officer came running up the spiral stairs.
"My lord, there is a Nadir rider waiting at Eldibar."
Wreck and Bowman walked together to Wall 1. Below them, on a grey step pony, sat Ulric, lord of the Nadir, dressed in fur-trimmed helmet, woolen jerkin, and goatskin boots. He looked up as Wreck leaned over the ramparts.
"You fought well, Earl of Bronze," he shouted. "I came to bid you farewell. There is civil war in my own kingdom, and I must leave you for a while. I wanted you to know that I shall return." "I will be here," said Wreck, "and next time your reception will be even warmer. Tell me,
Why did your men retire when we were beaten?
Do you believe in fate? Asked Ulrich.
I do.
Then let us call it a trick of fate. Or perhaps it was a cosmic jest, a joke played by the gods. I care not. You are a brave man. Your men are brave men. And you have won. I can live with that, Earl of Bronze. A poor man would I be if I could not. But for now, farewell. I shall see you again in the spring.
Ulrich waved, turned his pony's head and galloped off into the north.
Do you know, said Bowman, although it may sound grotesque, I think I like the man.
Today I could like anybody, said Rex, smiling. The sky is clear, the wind is fresh, and life tastes very fine.
What will you do now?
I think I will become a monk and devote my entire life to prayer and good works.
No, said Rex, I mean, what will you do today? Ah, today I'll get drunk and go whoring, said Bowman.
Throughout the long day, Rex periodically visited the sleeping Virai. Her colour was good, her breathing deep and even. Late in the evening, as he sat alone in the small hall before a dying fire, she came to him, dressed in a light green woolen tunic. He stood and took her into his arms, kissed her, then sat down in the leather chair and pulled her to his lap.
"The Nadir have really gone?"
she asked.
"They have indeed. Rick, did I truly die? It seems like a dream now. Hazy. I seem to remember Servitar bringing me back, and my body lay in a glass block beneath the keep."
"It was not a dream," said Rex.
"Do you remember coming to me as I fought a giant worm and a huge spider?" "Vaguely, but it's fading even as I remember it."
"Don't worry about it. I will tell you everything during the next 50 years or so."
"Only 50 years, she said. "So you will desert me when I'm old and grey."
The sound of laughter echoed through the keep. Epilogue. Ulrich never returned to Drostelnok. He defeated Jahangir in a pitched battle at Golgothir Plain, and then took his army to invade Ventria. During the campaign, he collapsed and died. The tribes fled back to the north, and without his influence, Nadir unity was broken. Civil war came once more to the north, and the people of the rich southlands breathed again. Rek was welcomed as a hero in Drenan, but soon tired of the city life and returned with Virai to Delnok. Their family grew over the years with 3 sons and 2 daughters. The sons were Hogun, Orin, and Horeb. The daughters were Susai and Besa. Grandfather Horeb brought his family from Drenan to Delnok, taking over the inn of the traitor Musa. Orin returned to Drenan and resigned from the army. His uncle Abelain retired from public life, and Magnus Woundweaver was elected to lead the council. He chose Orin as his deputy. Bowman remained at Delnok for a year, then travelled to Ventria to fight the Nadir once more. He did not return.
Afterward. David Gemmell was an only child, often lonely, and like many such children, he lived in his own head, making up stories for himself based on the ones he read in books. He started writing them down, short action tales, adventures of high romance and poetry. Later on, he became a journalist, and perhaps this satisfied his drive for creativity for a while. When he was 28 and working on a newspaper in Hastings, he was told he might have cancer. Tests were done, and he had to wait 2 weeks for the results. Never a patient man, he found that fortnight a very long one. He was at home on sick leave, bored and anxious, and his wife Val suggested he try writing a novel. So he dug out his old manual typewriter and sat down to create, at breakneck speed, a tale called The Siege of Drostelnok. It was a story of heroes, in which the greatest fortress in the world is under attack by the greatest army in the world. As he worked, David decided privately that if he had cancer, then the fortress would fall, and if he was in the clear, Drostelnok would survive. The Siege of Drostelnok was the highest of high fantasy. The hero spoke rather formally, even in the throes of battle or lovemaking, as if conscious of his status in an epic tale. The heroine was feisty but fragrant. David admitted later that the book wasn't very good, and after he got the all clear from the hospital, he gave a sigh of relief and put the manuscript away in a drawer for a few years. When he eventually took it out again to reread, he saw it was a heavily derivative mix of stories he had loved as a youngster. The Lord of the Rings, the Conan books, and the Western tales of his favourite author, Louis L'Amour, could all be seen in there. But he also realised it had three things going for it. Structurally, it was almost perfect. The battle scenes, though a little stylized, were active and vivid. And the heart of the book, the old warrior Druss, based on his stepfather Bill, was a flesh-and-blood character who leaped off the pages, dragging the rest of the cast with him. So he set about rewriting the book from scratch, this time putting real people, some of whom he worked with, at the centre of the action. He ditched the high-flown language, the elegant but bloodless swordplay, the declarative statements about love, honour, and the meaning of civilization. You can still see the influences on it, but this time he cherry-picked the best bits. Drostelnok recalls a darker Minas Tirith. The desultory conversations of the defending soldiers echo the dry-as-dust humour of L'Amour's laconic cowboys and black-clad gunslingers. And the essential central character of Druss draws on Robert E. Howard's Warrior King. This time around, the heroine, Virai, is a stroppy trainee harridan with commitment issues. Rek, the hero, is a coward who only goes to Drostelnok because he fears losing his love more than he fears losing his life. The minor characters jump off the pages now because David observed his friends and colleagues at work and translated the dynamics of an average working office into credible day-to-day dramas of ordinary folk in a fortress under siege. And above them all strode Druss, with his great axe, Snaga. Like Conan the Barbarian, Druss was no mere big bruiser, but a strategist and a born commander of men. Druss also shares Conan's wanderlust, and had travelled the Draenei world on a path which took him from battle to battle, and finally led him, as he had always known it would, to meet death on the walls of Drostelnok. By the time he reaches the fortress, his legend has travelled ahead of him, and we understand his mythic status because of the other characters' reactions to him. David was in the grip of obsession. He took the manuscript to the office with him and worked on it through lunch hours and in downtime. After everyone else had gone home at night, he was still at his desk, tapping away. Even on press days, he would only stop typing for long enough to read a galley proof, then turn back to the typewriter to finish a sentence. He took a lot of stick from the other journalists and the printers who recognised the obsession and teased him about it. Dave just smiled and carried on typing. He knew he was telling a cracking story. He threw into it everything he knew of life and everything he wanted from it. He wore his heart on his sleeve, careless of what he gave away of his own ambitions, hopes and dreams. A deeply romantic man, he believed in the strength of love, the possibility of redemption, and the power of the source. When he was finished, he had to decide what to call the book. The Siege of Drostelnok was too explanatory. He toyed with The Legend of Drostelnok and Druss the Legend and a dozen other titles. The only thing he was certain about was that it had the word legend in it. Friends and colleagues offered suggestions, many of them unprintable. It was a surprisingly long time before he realised the only right and proper title. When it came out in 1984, David eagerly searched Hastings bookstores, looking for a copy, and at last found two in a small seafront shop. He hated the first paperback cover, which, he said, looked like a hamster in armour. Legend was a moderate success, and sales were sufficient for his publishers to ask for more books. In the following 22 years, he wrote 30 more books, but Legend was always his favourite, as it is the favourite of a legion of fans. He worked on his craft and his writing skills improved, his characters becoming more complex and more conflicted. He added layers of grey to the black-and-white clarity of legend, but as he always said, if you add too much grey, all you have is a grey book. He returned to sieges a number of times, but it was not until the final trilogy that he tackled the greatest siege story of all, that of Troy. He did not live to finish the final book. Appropriately, for this time, of course, the fortress did fall. Stella Gemmell, 2009.
You've been listening to an Orion audiobook, Legend, Book One in the Drenai Saga, by David Gemmell, read by Sean Barrett, produced by RNIB Studios. Text copyright, David Gemmell, 1984. Production copyright, Orion Publishing Group Limited, 2017. For information about other Orion audiobooks, visit the website at www.orionbooks.co.uk.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.